Good morning. It is so good to be back among such good friends. We were just chatting earlier before the service and we came to realize that we're actually like part of the furniture now. We fit right in. We're very settled. I seem to know most of your faces and it's just a delight to be back. So thank you for the invitation. I'm going to be back again before Christmas, and so I've put together two messages that sort of work as a pair. And they're going to be two of the signs, two of the miracles out of the book of John. The first one and the last one, the wedding at Cana and the raising of Lazarus. John, in his gospel, chose seven signs, only seven. And he freely admits at the end of his book that if he was to record all of the signs, all of the things that Jesus said and did, then the world wouldn't be big enough to hold the books that it would take to write that down. So John very carefully selected seven signs that Jesus did, that he witnessed Jesus do. And using those seven signs and some conversations, some teaching moments, John crafts his thesis about Jesus. John gives us the truth about Jesus as John witnessed it. He is the Son of God. He is the living God. He is the Christ of God. And he tells us right at the beginning, in the introduction to his gospel, that the law came through Moses. I'm in chapter 1 and verse 17. The law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And then that Jesus came to explain the unseeable God. That's what John wants us to see as he works with us through the signs and the teachings of Jesus Christ in his gospel. Now, we're going to a place in Upper Galilee called Cana. And even if you had a map of the day, back in the day, Cana would not be on it. It's one of those greasy spots on the map. It really wasn't anything more than a hamlet. A few families, a few farmers, nothing more. And it wasn't far from Nazareth, the town where Jesus himself grew up as a boy in the family of Joseph and Mary. Just a few miles between the two towns. And Nazareth was sort of insignificant too. Perhaps 30 families living in a farming community with terraces and vineyards and sheep and cattle. So when we go to the wedding at Cana, we're not expecting a big elaborate affair. We're not expecting Westminster Cathedral. We're expecting a small family affair. There are only just a few families there. And on the third day, beginning of chapter 2, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there, and Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. Now, one of those disciples was a young man by the name of Nathanael. Now, Nathanael was a homeboy from Cana. John tells us that at the end of his book. We have to wait to find that out, but I'm giving you a tip-off. Nathanael is from Cana. This is his home village. So Nathanael is coming home having met Jesus and having been recruited into Jesus' followers. In fact, Nathanael, just a few verses before, has blurted out his opinion of what it is that Jesus is. Nathanael answered Jesus, "Rabbi, teacher, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And Jesus hadn't actually done much at that point. Nathanael was sold out for Jesus. He made his proclamation of faith before he saw this first sign. But imagine coming with your King of Israel friend to your little hometown village, to this little local wedding. Can you imagine what was on Nathanael's mind coming home with the Son of God, the Messiah of Israel in tow? What fun that must have been. Think of the dynamics. There couldn't have been more than 50 people there in the whole town. And here's Nathanael, local boy made good. Look, I found the king. I found Messiah. He's right here. I know him. He's my friend. And he's come to this wedding. He's come because he was invited. Nazareth, Cana, two little villages side by side. It's like Great Chart and Little Chart. They're about that far apart. It's not far, and they know each other. So growing up in Nazareth, automatically we have to assume that Jesus would have known the people in Cana. Perhaps they were kindred to Mary and Joseph. This might have been a cousin's wedding in some regard. But Jesus and his friends are invited to the wedding. Jesus' mother is one of the characters to watch in this story. It's a humorous story, if you give me time to develop it. When the wine ran out, verse 3, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with me?" And don't be offended by the fact that Jesus referred to his mother as woman. That wasn't impolite. I wouldn't dare do it to my mum. But in that language and in that culture and in that time, there was nothing wrong with that. He addressed his mother as woman. It's like calling her ma'am. Ma'am as in ham, not mom as in palm. It's like calling her ma'am. This doesn't have anything to do with me yet. It's not my time yet. I'm not about my work yet. There's something about Mary, though. She knows her boy, and she knows the origins of her boy. Remember, she was there when he was born. And she understands the circumstances of his birth. She knows that there is something special about this boy. She hid those things in her heart. And she thinks perhaps now, while these family friends are embarrassed, perhaps now while these close friends are embarrassed for wine at their wedding, perhaps now he can at least give a little encouragement. At least perhaps now he can speak to them or do something. Jesus said, well, it's actually not time. It's not time yet. My hour has not yet come. But his mother, bless her, doesn't hear a thing of it. She doesn't hear a word of his protest. Oh, she says to the servants, whatever he says, you do it. He's in charge. He'll take care of it. Whatever he says, do it. Now, the problem of having no wine at the wedding was a bigger problem than we might anticipate. Because at every wedding, there had to be some adjudicators. A rabbi would have to be there. There would be at least one of the Pharisees there. They loved to go to weddings so they could pick holes in the arrangements. It had to be just right. All of the persnickety little rules had to be observed. Just right. All the guests had to be able to wash their hands. Just right. And there had to be sufficient banquet to make the wedding just right. And in fact, if the family who was hosting the wedding banquet failed to put on a good show, if it wasn't a big enough spread, if they ran out of refreshments, as is the case here, then the rabbis and the Pharisees could declare the marriage null and void because it wasn't fulfilled in the obligation of the groom. There could even be fines imposed. If you read the Talmud and the Mishnah, they document all this. They're really good at persnickety little rules. If you go to the Western Wall in Jerusalem today, just up the hill away from the wall a little bit, as you walk in, you'll see what looked to us like drinking fountains. It's just fountains of water flowing out in a sort of a rosette, and attached to each spigot, each flowing tap, there is a cup with two handles on it. And that cup is for the ceremonial washing before you go down to the wall to pray. And the observant Jews, and also the respectful Gentiles, will be careful to get it just right because they're really persnickety about it. The two handles are important. You have one handle that you hold it with. That's the left handle. You hold it with your left hand, and you take water and you wash your right hand. And only at that point, once your right hand is ceremonially clean, are you allowed to grab the cup by the clean handle and then fill it up and wash the other hand. It doesn't make sense to us because that's just persnickety. But for them, this is crucial. And they have people watching. They have people observing and standing and snickering at the Gentiles as they come and try to do this all. But they're still doing this. They're still tied up with their ceremonial washings. I just say that to make the point. What Jesus is doing here, he is about to say to those ones who like to keep their persnickety rules, he's about to say, you can't have it both ways. He's about to say, you can't have law under Moses and grace and truth under Christ the Messiah. It's exactly what John said at the beginning, and it's exactly what we're about to discover here. His mother said, do whatever he tells you. Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, for the hand washings. You needed lots of water for the Pharisees and the rabbis and the observant law keepers to be able to wash their hands right. Under these circumstances, a servant would do the pouring. You wouldn't need the two-handed cup. But you'd still have to get it right. There were regulations and rules about how far down your forearm the water was supposed to travel before your hand was considered clean. How many drips drip off your elbow before the whole forearm is considered clean. And they would observe, and they would count, and they would watch. They would scrutinize. They wanted to make sure it was all just right. So there were six stone water jars there for these washing rituals, for these laws, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars up with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And then he said to them, now draw some out, take it to the master of the feast. Take it to the master of ceremonies. Take it to the man who's making sure everything happens okay. So they took it. And the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine, and he didn't know where it had come from, although the servants who'd drawn the water knew. And the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, and this is an interesting little piece of social observation. Everybody serves the good wine first, and then when the people are drunk, then they bring out the bad stuff. But you've kept the best stuff till last. Jesus had made wine to save embarrassment to this friend's family, to save possibly the annulment of the wedding because of the judgment, the stipulation of the Pharisees and the rabbis. To save a whole lot of embarrassment, Jesus gave them this extraordinary wedding gift. Six jugs of wine, each one holding at least 20 gallons. That's a lot of wine for a little village. That's enough wine for a year in a town the size of Cana. What a remarkable wedding gift. What a wonderful thing for him to do. Just on the surface of it, just on the gift of it, just on the giving of this wine to a small, poor family in a small, poor town. This, says John, is the first of his signs that Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now, I come back to Nathanael. Nathanael has already believed in him. Nathanael's the local boy made good. Nathanael is the one who's come to town saying, I've brought the Messiah, the King of Israel, the Son of the Living God with me to this little local wedding. Let's see what will happen. And then all of the disciples, not all of them had blurted out such a well-rounded faith in the person of Christ by now. They were just there watching. And all of the disciples, it said, put their faith in him. They believed in him. This simple sign, this one thing that Jesus did, cemented the faith of his disciples. It locked it in. How so? What is the significance of this? Grace had come in Jesus Christ, and the law that had come through Moses was passing away because he had come to fulfill it. He had come to make it essentially obsolete. And this was the first hint that we get at that. Put yourself in the sandals of a Pharisee who's at this wedding. Put yourself in the sandals of the man who's come to adjudicate. And the wedding can go ahead as planned. It's a legit wedding because they've got plenty of refreshments now, and this wonderful, incomprehensible thing has happened. They had no wine, and now they've got loads of wine, and okay, well, let's get stuck in. Let's all go and wash our hands. Up for the ritual, everybody. Oh, wait a minute. We can't have our ritual. We can't have our legalism. We can't have our persnickety little rules satisfied. Because our washing jugs, well, they're all full of this fabulous wine. We're stuck. Do you realize what Jesus was doing there? He was throwing down the gauntlet to the legalists. He was saying, you can't have it both ways. You can't have your persnickety little rules and have grace and truth at the same time. You can't come to the banquet if all you're doing is nitpicking. There's no fun in that. There's no joy in that. There's bondage in that. He came to give us life and give it to us abundantly so that it bubbles up out of us and gives us enthusiasm. The law works the other way. The law binds us down. It constricts us. It restricts our movements. It gives us lists of things we cannot do instead of letting us fulfill the things that we love to do. Worship and praise and fellowship. We can't be free unless we embrace what Jesus did here. He transformed things. This ministry of Jesus is the ministry of transformation. That's why Christians are different on the inside, not just on the outside. You're not a Christian because you behave differently. You're not a Christian because you keep a set of rules. You're not a Christian because you know the rules and you keep them better than the next guy. You're a Christian because Christ has transformed you on the middle and now you are constituted differently. You're made of new stuff. You're made of wine which makes the hearts of men glad, as it would be said. You're made of the stuff of the party, not the stuff of the courtroom. Don't you feel it? Can't you embrace it? Can't you, if you'll pardon the expression, just drink it in? Can't you feel how much freedom there is when Christ transforms you on the inside and liberates you to enjoy the things that he approves of, rather than being forced to avoid the things that he might not like? You see, the Pharisees were all about that. The Pharisees weren't about pleasing God. The Pharisees were about avoiding offending God. They created rules upon rules upon rules, a whole superstructure a scaffolding of rules around the essential teachings of Moses, so that nobody could even get in close to risk breaking the law of Moses. It was a big fence that they built. We're supposed to keep the Sabbath. We're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, they say. But if you read the Mishnah and then later on the Talmud, they turned that into a huge, burdensome boatload of regulations. Well, what is it to work? Let me think now. Or what's a tailor's work? Well, a tailor sews. So therefore, it should be forbidden that a tailor should carry a needle on the Sabbath. Because that's work. That's his stock in trade. That's what he does. So if a tailor, perchance, by mistake, has a needle still tucked in his lapel while he walks around, he's in violation of the Sabbath law in the eyes of the Pharisees. Well, plowing is working, isn't it? Shouldn't plow on the Sabbath according to the law of Moses. What does plowing constitute? Well, it's making a rut in the ground, isn't it, really, when you boil it down? Okay, so we can't have anybody moving chairs because they'll drag a furrow in the dust on the floor. So you can't move a chair on the Sabbath, according to the Pharisees. They filled up their minds, they filled up their law books with hundreds and hundreds of petty little regulations like this. Come the Feast of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths, the great big joyful celebration for the harvest home in Israel. At the end of the harvest, at the end of the autumn, when all the crops are in and the new wine is ready, and we're supposed to live out in booths, we're supposed to live in bivouacs for a week to celebrate the fact that the people of Israel lived in tents in the desert while they wandered in the wilderness. Well, they would take that, which is supposed to sound like a really fun idea. The nation Israel goes camping for a week, and then they start to tie down, well, what does a bivouac constitute? What is a tabernacle? If it's got rush matting on the ceiling, on the roof of it, how much of that is enough to call it a roof? And how much is it just a shade? Well, how many stars are you supposed to be able to see through the gaps of it at night? They had regulations for all of that stuff. Drive you crazy. And there are some legalists in this world that drive you crazy too. Little persnickety rules, rather than being filled with the grace and the joy and the effervescent love of God. I get excited about this miracle. It means so much to me. The law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We can relax. We can enjoy, we can partake, we can thrill with the fun of it, the fellowship. Christian unity ought to feel like fun. It ought to feel like joy in your veins. It ought to put a spring in your step, doesn't it? It does for me. I hope you can tell. I love going all up and down the country and even recently out of the country and meeting Christians, just meeting people. They don't perhaps do things exactly the same way that we would do them. They don't perhaps see the traditions of the church in exactly the same way that we might see them. But they love Christ, and there's a joy in their heart, and there is a sparkle in their eyes, and there is an enthusiasm in the way that they engage life because simply of this fact. Jesus has transformed them. He's taken the water of their legalism and he's turned it into the joyful wine of grace in love. Now, I had a professor at seminary one time, who was teaching us through this passage in one of the classes, and he said, now, lads, don't get carried away. This isn't a reason for us all to go down to the corner store and stock up on Thunderbird. He says, moderation is key. Moderation is significant. He was a dear old man. He had a twinkle in his eye. He had so much fun about him. You could tell that he loved this miracle as much as I loved this miracle. The humor in it. Can you imagine being a Pharisee at that wedding and coming to the stone jars, getting ready to wash your hands before the supper, and you're mumbling to yourself, somebody's going to hang for this. And you know what? He did. This was the beginning. This was the beginning of Jesus Christ dismantling the argument of the Pharisees, dismantling their way of being such a burden on the people, of taking all the fun out of life, of sucking all the joy out of it. And this was the beginning. This was the first of the signs. And it was a gauntlet that Jesus threw down, saying, you can't have it both ways. I am about transformation, not restriction. I am about new life. I am about joy, not oppressive legalism. He says to the Pharisees, choose. You can either stay and enjoy this feast. You can stay and enjoy this blessing. You can stay and enjoy this really nice wine that I've created. Or you can go away, unblessed and unwashed. But you can't have it both ways. You can't have it both ways. Law and grace, they are essential, but they are essential for different reasons. Paul tells us that the law came as a tutor. The law came as a schoolmaster. The law came to show us how far wrong we were. Nobody could live up to the law, because we've all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And that's why we need grace. That's why we need transformation. That's why we need to be made new inside and not just squeezed into a mold outside. And that is what Jesus announces. If you don't feel this kind of effervescent joy, simply in the fact that Jesus has come to change you, then you should be asking yourself why. Because this kind of joy, this kind of thrill, it transcends all of the trials and the tribulations of ordinary life. This is a much bigger joy than any disaster can steal. Sure, we become despondent. Sure, we become disappointed. Sure, things happen to us that bring us to our knees and make us cry out in lament to God. But there is always the knowledge. There is always the security. There is always the joy in knowing that you are different. You have been transformed. Jesus Christ has made you new on the inside, and he's done it to give you life abundant, life overflowing, life eternal. I like to put myself in Nathaniel's shoes. Just a little country boy. Not very important. If it weren't for the scriptures, nobody would remember his name. But Jesus, the Son of God, the King of Israel, the Messiah, changed him. changed him. And the symbol of the change happened in his hometown. And it can happen in your heart today. If you find yourself dry, disappointed, miserable, Jesus can transform you. He can turn your tears to joy. He can turn your sorrow to rejoicing. He can turn your life around if you'll simply let him. Mary said, "He's in charge, just do what he says." And what he says is, "Come to me if you're heavy laden. Come to me if you're weary. Come to me if you're ground down by life, because my yoke is so light. Come to Jesus today and let him transform you." Amen.